bringing you unique perspectives from inside the world of addiction and mental health recovery. This is Recovery Unscripted.
Hi guys, welcome to another episode of Recovery Unscripted. I'm David Kondos, and this podcast is powered by Foundations Recovery Network. On today's show, I'm joined by Dr. Julie Friedman, a health psychologist in the specialties of binge eating disorder, night eating syndrome, and cognitive behavioral therapy. In addition to leading the binge eating treatment program at Eating Recovery Center in Chicago, she also serves as a professor at the Northwestern University School of Medicine. She sat down with me at the Moments of Change conference in Florida to explore the intersection of food, mental health, substance use, and healing. Now, here's Julie. I'm here with Julie Friedman. Thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here. First, let's have you tell us a little bit about your own kind of personal journey and how you started serving in this field.
So I was coming from an academic medicine background. I was at a local academic medical center, and I was in an obesity medicine clinic or practice. So if you were above a certain BMI, you were automatically referred there. We would do any kind of care that a patient needed, whether it was exercise physiology, dietary, psychology, obviously my background, and or medical. I was doing largely a lot of health psychology, working with people on their sleep, working with people with regards to stress management, things like that. But we started to get more and more patients with binge eating, out of control eating, feeling as if they were addicted to food. It became so overwhelming in terms of the demand for that kind of service and the supply. I mean, we had a small department. So I contacted our local eating disorder facility in Chicago, Eating Recovery Center of Illinois. And I said, I have all of these people that I can send you, but you don't have a binge eating program. She said, what would you need to feel comfortable referring here? And so I started to outline our program or sort of my dream program. And I had a job offer, I think, within 2 hours after the lunch.
Wow, yeah.
So I came out of academia into the eating disorder treatment space. And we designed, as I said, the program 3 years ago, launched it initially in Chicago. So we started with an intensive outpatient program that grew. So we launched residential, and we're actually opening a larger residential facility, and that will be 30 beds just for the loss of control eating disorder patient.
Yeah. And so did you start out kind of in academia? You said psychology is kind of your background.
Yeah. So I got my PhD in clinical psychology, and I originally started actually as a sleep psychologist. And again, the majority of the patients that were coming through were higher weight, really struggling with a number of different issues from a psychiatric or psychological standpoint. And all that we were offering them was basically to tell them to lose weight. It just felt like we have to offer more to these people. And it felt like such general weight bias in our healthcare, you know, system, that all of your questions will be answered when you lose weight. And it really was inadequate treatment of the patient. So it just felt like we're calling obesity a medical disease, which it certainly is, but we're not treating it like one. We're treating it like a personal failing.
Kind of like substance use and mental health and all that.
Actually, I see a lot of parallels between substance use disorder treatment and treatment for these patients in terms of, again, being marginalized and underserved population, and this implication that if they just buckled down, and showed more willpower, showed more discipline, they would get better. And that's not the case. And there's strong medical and biological components to their disease, just like in substance use disorders.
Also here at the conference, you just gave a presentation discussing the validity of food addiction in the treatment of binge eating disorder. I'm guessing there's a lot of kind of skepticism about that. And so could you kind of start by saying, what would you say to someone who questions whether food addiction is a real thing?
So it's really a field that's in its infancy, right? So we don't have good human studies to suggest that human beings can be addicted in the traditional sense, with withdrawal and tolerance and cravings and urges to use despite negative consequences. I mean, the way we would talk about substance use, we don't have good evidence to suggest that humans can be addicted to a specific nutrient. When you look at the research, it's very much rodent-based, where if you give rats unlimited access to sugar sweetened water, they keep going back for more. And so in humans, what we see is that, yes, the same reward pathways are implicated, certainly. You know, just like in substance use disorder, we see less dopamine receptors, so less reward in the reward centers, and less activity or activation in the inhibitory control centers. I need more and more of something to get reward. And then once I start engaging in a behavior, it's very difficult for me to stop.
So it's following a similar biological pattern.
Exactly. Where it is different is that we know that chronic substance use will really alter the central nervous system, you know, and cause some changes in the brain. We don't have good evidence that food can do that. We have good evidence that food activates the same channels, but we don't have evidence that consumption of food really changes those pathways. We do have evidence, however, that consumption or overconsumption of highly palatable and highly processed foods does start to cause some dropout of the neurons that regulate appetite. So people who have, you know, a high consumption of these foods, particularly in binge eating, night eating, these sort of loss control eating disorders, then the neurons that inhibit appetite or help a patient feel satiated start to die out. It's less a reward system issue in the way that substance use is, and more of a hunger and satiety mechanism issue that gets disrupted when somebody has the constant inflammatory stress of binging. Most people who describe a food addiction don't describe pouring salt in their mouths. They describe going for potato chips, which are high fat and salty. And so again, this idea of the compulsion towards highly processed, highly palatable foods because it feels good to eat them. And then when you eat them, it stops the production of stress hormones in your body and stops the wanting of them. It's a very reinforcing behavior. Do we have evidence that it's addictive? Not yet. This is really a field that's in its infancy right now.
I guess, is it too early to have a definition, or how would you define food addiction in your work?
Well, there's definitely a definition. There's a scale that's sort of the gold standard, the most well-established measure of food addiction. It's the Yale Food Addiction Scale. And they define food addiction as a clinically significant physical or psychological dependence on certain nutrients or foods. There was a new YFAS or Yale Food Addiction Scale released with the advent of DSM-5. Because substance use disorder changed. There were some changes to that diagnosis. So the YFAS changed to basically mirror the substance use disorder criteria. So now we really look at how can food parallel what some of those, you know, again, cravings, withdrawal, tolerance, continuing to use, even though there are negative consequences.
So a lot of the signs and symptoms are pretty similar.
Exactly. And that's what the YFAS was meant to do, was really apply it towards binge eating or out of control eating, just as we did with substance use disorder. I think the problem is that there's a lot of overlap, really substantial overlap between binge eating disorder and food addiction. So it sort of begs the question, are we measuring a distinct entity, or are we really measuring a more chronic, more severe, more treatment resistant version of binge eating disorder? And the evidence really suggests that we're measuring severity of psychopathology and obesity severity as well, because food addiction is much more prevalent, 4 to 5 times as prevalent in higher weight populations. So it seems to be this proxy for psychopathology in addition to obesity severity.
So it's kind of a manifestation, or?
Yeah, I would say it's sort of, there's sort of an additive effect where you have a binge eating disorder that's fairly clearly defined in our diagnostic manual. And then you have this concept of food addiction, which really is a more severe variant of binge eating plus other sort of markers. You know, we know trauma severity. For instance, if you have an extensive trauma history, your chances of being diagnosed with food addiction go up. Again, the higher weight you are, there's a positive correlation with YFAST scores. So the more you weigh, the more likely you are to meet criteria for this. So that's where there are some measurement issues in that A, it's a self-report measure, but B, it does seem to be tapping other things other than this distinct entity from binge eating disorder. So I think it needs a little bit of refinement.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, like you said, it's all kind of new.
In its infancy. Yes. So
seeing it develop in real time.
Yes.
When a lot of people think of eating disorders, they probably think of like anorexia or bulimia, yes, kind of like you said earlier. But I know just from the little bit of research I did for this interview that there are a lot of other conditions that people probably don't know as much about. And so one that you've mentioned a couple times here is binge eating disorder. It's kind of one of your specialties, it sounds like. Could you kind of describe what that entails and kind of what you do with it?
So binging, and the way we define a binge eating episode would be eating more in a discrete period of time than most people would eat in the same time period and under similar circumstances, and feeling a loss of control while you're eating, like you can't stop yourself from eating. It's important to note, I think, everybody binges. Binging is part of the normal continuum of eating behavior, but what differentiates normative binging from a binge eating disorder would be binging one time a week for a duration of 3 months or more. So we really took the model or the paradigm from substance use disorder. Can we get somebody out of their environment, interrupt the behavior, and treat them really intensively, give them a ton of skills, and then send them back to their home environment with good aftercare planning? And that's really the approach we took for binge eating disorder.
Yeah, and then night eating disorder was another one I saw mentioned that I'm not familiar with. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. Night eating syndrome involves essentially a circadian delay in food intake. So it would be a patient essentially waiting until noon or later to eat 4 or more mornings per week or skipping breakfast entirely, eating 25% or more of their total daily calories between dinner and bedtime, after dinner, and then having some form of sleep disturbance, whether they have difficulty falling asleep or they have difficulty staying asleep. So these patients can wake up in the middle of the night, eat, and go back to bed, but it's not a necessary criteria. So I think it goes undiagnosed, and it's really significant in terms of disrupting a patient's life. You're not eating properly during the day, makes it hard to function during the day, but most importantly, they become so sleep deprived that impairs their daytime functioning as well. And it's associated with some mood changes, depressive symptoms, an increase in nocturnal anxiety, things like that.
Yeah. And so what are some of the kind of most common causes that you see? I was looking at the website. It had, you know, biological, environmental, cultural. What are some of the causes you see for these different conditions we've been talking about?
I would say that eating disorders are about 80% genetic and neurobiological.
Really? Wow.
Absolutely. So I think you've got the genetic predisposition. And yes, there are certain environmental factors that can bring them out. For instance, perfectionistic temperament. But in general, these are really neurobiologically based disorders. To give you an example, leptin. Okay, leptin is a satiety hormone. It tells us to stop eating, store energy, you're full. We know with anorexia nervosa, these patients have low levels of leptin, which means that they have an increased sensitivity to feeling full. Now, with binge eating disorder, we see the opposite. They have high levels of leptin. So they have all this leptin floating around and they're unable to use it. And so we know that they have an insensitivity to feeling full.
Yeah. And so here, just want to make sure I understand. So that the leptin, it's naturally created in their body and they get like a tolerance to it to where they don't feel full like someone who doesn't have that would feel full.
Exactly. Their brain, essentially, leptin receptors are unable to use it. And so a lot of this is brain-based and a lot of it is a dysfunction in the way that the brain and the gut communicate to one another. There are a lot of neurobiological factors, dopamine, serotonin. I mean, there are a lot of things that have been implicated. I will say that the main psychological or behavioral variable that has been implicated is avoidance of feeling bad, feeling uncomfortable, using a behavior to make that go away very quickly. We call that negative urgency. That's certainly related to eating disordered behaviors, but it doesn't cause eating disordered behaviors. It's a contributor.
Related to that, you mentioned earlier that you have like a mood and anxiety specific program. Could you say a little bit about how those interact with the eating disorders, kind of what role that can play?
Sure. So 85% of patients with eating disorders will also meet criteria for a comorbid mood or anxiety disorder. So it's very, very common. We don't know, you know, what comes first, the chicken or the egg. Did somebody start depressed and then develop an eating disorder, vice versa? We don't know. But certainly in all of our eating disorder programs, we have to do good mood and anxiety work or we're setting our patients up to relapse. Our mood and anxiety program, we were getting all these calls and people were asking, well, I don't have an eating disorder, but can I come and do your programming? I mean, there was this need for it. So the mood and anxiety program was born. That programming is for patients who don't have any eating disordered pathology. So if you have, let's say, anxiety, generalized anxiety disorder and binge eating disorder, you would go into the binge eating disorder program. We would treat both. But for patients who really want this kind of treatment and did not have eating disorder symptoms, we wanted to give them something and offer some treatment for them as well.
And then I also saw in your bio that cognitive behavioral therapy is one of your specialties. How have you seen CBT help those with eating disorders? Because I know that's something that we see a lot with addiction. So I'm interested to hear that.
Yes. And CBT is the most well-established psychological treatment for binge eating disorder. I mean, all of the studies really bear that out. Part of the rationale for that, or part of the reason why we think that is because in order to arrest somebody's behaviors, you've got to work on the behaviors directly. So a lot of patients come in and they feel like, if I just learn why I have an eating disorder, it'll just magically make these behaviors go away. And we know that's not the case. You can have great insight, but if you aren't taught to do something different, particularly in times in which you're vulnerable to cravings and urges and things like that, you're not going to be very successful in managing your disorder. So I think the present focus of CBT, I think the behavioral focus of CBT, certainly that let's intervene with your behaviors first because it's what we have the most control over. We have less control over how you feel. And so we really work with patients to abandon some of that control. Like, let's accept how you feel and move on because your feelings are your feelings and they're biologically determined. We're going to help you engage in different behaviors when you feel these feelings. But at the end of the day, if you don't behave differently, life isn't going to look very different for you.
Yeah, just like with addiction, you got to find a different way to cope with what you have going on.
Absolutely. And again, I'm not saying that insight-oriented therapies aren't great because it's amazing to know why you do what you do. I mean, it really is. It's great. It just doesn't help somebody recover from an eating disorder or from a substance use disorder for that matter. They really need a whole new set of skills, coping skills, and behavioral interventions.
Then kind of moving to the next thing, there's a lot of similarities, like we've said, but something that's different from substance use is that food is all around us. It's a necessary part of life. I guess, how do you help people transition back into life when they're going to be around food all the time? They have to eat food. Abstinence isn't really an option for them.
Exactly. So I think a lot of planning and a lot of prep in the sense that yes, you have to eat, but you can be mindful about the way that you incorporate triggering foods into your diet.
So it's more about the mental, like how you kind of view food.
Yeah, and I think planning ahead for it. I think the worst thing that somebody with an eating disorder can do is eat something that is triggering to them impulsively. So the idea of, okay, you're not going to be abstinent from food. You're not going to be abstinent from your trigger foods. But maybe your abstinence looks like you don't eat a trigger food without planning it into, you know, 24 hours in advance in early recovery. Not going too long without eating. So having them plan ahead, having them carry food with them. How do we get some movement into your life every day? Because movement will help decrease some of the urges to binge, things like that.
Yeah. All right. So wrap up with this final question. You've given a lot of your life and your time and yourself to this mission. Like you said, you were at the university level for a while and now doing what you're doing with ERC. So could we wrap up by having you kind of sum up why helping others find recovery from eating disorders is so important to you?
I think that this is something that patients are really, really struggling with. They're struggling physically, they're struggling emotionally, and they're struggling with this public perception that this is something that is in their control entirely and that can be easily fixed if they show more discipline and willpower. So I think to me, the biggest thing is helping a population that's been largely stigmatized. And so that's important to me, that how can we take the blame away from the patient and give them the resources that they need to find recovery. And we've done it with substance use disorders. You know, we really have, where people recognize, okay, if my spouse is drinking every night, we need to send them to a place that will help contain the behavior and then get them back home. With eating disordered behaviors, that's not as obvious. So patients will come in and they are so sick medically, emotionally, psychiatrically, because they've gone so long without treatment because nobody identified their problem. And when they did identify the problem, they didn't treat it effectively or efficiently. So I think that's the biggest sort of take home for me, is how can we help a population that's so largely pleasant and sweet and wanting help and motivated, and really make eating disorder treatment accessible for not just wealthy patients. I don't want care to be just for people who can afford it. I want people to be able to use their mental health benefits for care. That mission really appeals to me in terms of helping people live better lives and lives outside of their eating disorder.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for your time. It's been a pleasure having you on, Julie.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Thanks again to Dr. Friedman for joining us. Now I'll close the show by featuring another story from the Heroes in Recovery community as part of our ongoing series called Hero of the Week. Today's story comes from Megan C., who shared it on heroesinrecovery.com, a grassroots movement where over 1,500 people have contributed their stories. At the age of 14, Megan began using food to cope with her social anxiety and depression. But the more her parents expressed concern, the more she hid her increasingly destructive eating habits. By the age of 25, she realized she had formed an addiction to food. After failed attempts to conquer the problem with diets and gym memberships, Megan's deteriorating health issues forced her to realize she didn't want to live like that anymore. She turned her feelings of sadness and hopelessness into motivation, and now enjoys a healthy relationship with food, bolstered by exercise, writing, meditation, therapy, and online support groups. As Megan says in her story, no matter how low you feel now, it can get better. One slip, one binge, one cookie does not make you a bad person or a failure. It means you just wipe it away and keep on going. Thank you for sharing that, Megan, and for helping to break the stigma around addiction and mental health issues. If you'd like to read Megan's full story or share your own, visit heroesinrecovery.com. This has been the Recovery Unscripted podcast. Today we've heard from Dr. Julie Friedman of Eating Recovery Center. For more about their work, visit eatingrecoverycenter.com. And thank you for listening. Please take a few seconds to leave us a rating on your podcast app and subscribe so you won't miss any of our new episodes. See you next time.